good horse, I call you my shiny black bass. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're listening to episode 640 of Unwelcome Guests, the making of the U.S. corporate empire. I'm Robin Upton, and exceptionally this week, spending the whole show on part one of a film adaptation. It's by Metanoia Films, who've produced a couple of other documentaries we've adapted on the show. It's a classic Unwelcome Guests theme, understanding the subterfuge, hypocrisy, and the greed which motivates what's really going on in the world, as opposed to what you're told in school or what you're told in the corporate controlled media. But it's right up to date, it was made just last year, and it consolidates a lot of the earlier material. So even without the video track, I hope you find it informative, and I dare say we'll find time for part two, the conclusion, perhaps next week or maybe the week after. And the film starts with verse 36 from chapter 8 of the book of Mark. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul?
November 1989. After more than a quarter of a century, the most visible symbol of the ideological divide between Soviet Russia and the United States is declared a non-entity. Since its creation, 171 people have been killed attempting to cross the Berlin Wall. Now, a euphoric public chips away at what is soon to be a relic of the Cold War. For Americans, it was the end of an era. And soon, a new president would be sworn into office to realize the dreams of a world without a major military rival.
So help me God.
Many believed that the specter of what President Eisenhower had termed the military-industrial complex would become a thing of the past. Rather than devoting enormous sums to military spending, taxpayer funds could now be allocated to a radical expansion in healthcare and other forms of social spending. The dream was not to be. On February 1st, 1999, the Clinton administration released its new federal budget. It contained a tiny 3% increase in spending on social programs. Meanwhile, $112 billion in new funds were allocated to the military, while the budget of the CIA and other intelligence agencies rose to $29 billion. Clinton had promised what he called a peace dividend, and delivered in the form of modest cuts to some elements of the military. Yet at the same time, his administration expanded the influence of the Pentagon in key areas. One of their most significant acts was to end the official ban on advanced arms exports to Latin America and the former Soviet bloc countries. Secretary of State Warren Christopher instructed U.S. embassies to help American arms companies promote trade. Christopher had previously served as director of Lockheed Martin, the largest arms manufacturer in the world. The rise in arms sales coincided with a massive increase in privatization. Many of the jobs cut from the military were simply transferred to private contractors, over 100,000 by the end of Clinton's first term. In the wake of 9/11, the American military budget doubled to over $700 billion. Today, it is estimated at over $1 trillion.
I've said that we need to increase the size of our military, which politically, if it got to the floor, probably would pass. But there, as you know, a whole bunch of folks on the left who think that that is a waste of money. I think it's important for us to do.
As a whole, the U.S. now spends as much on war as the rest of the world combined. An estimated 800 U.S. military bases in at least 150 countries crisscross the globe. To put these numbers in perspective, more money is now spent on air conditioning for American military personnel than the entire budget of NASA. In the halls of power, the idea of initiating significant cuts to war spending has become almost unthinkable. This film will examine the reasons why.
The Power Principle, Part 1, Empire.
Village squares and public grounds, their memory and the memory of all their brothers in arms before them are enshrined in a chain of tribute that reaches back across the developing story of the nation itself. Its recognition of its manifest destiny to be strong enough to support freedom beyond its own shores.
Over 200 years ago, the philosopher Adam Smith made a remarkable prediction. He claimed that America would become an extensive empire, which seems very likely to become one of the greatest and most formidable that ever was in the world. George Washington agreed, suggesting that the new republic was an infant empire. It would take nearly two centuries for the prophecy of Adam Smith to be fully realized. Most historians trace the explosion of American interventionism to the Monroe Doctrine of 1823, but it was only during the 20th century that the empire would become truly global. Following World War II, two major players were left standing, the United States and the Soviet Union. Yet, there was a significant power imbalance. During World War II, over 20 million Russians had perished at the hands of the Third Reich. The Red Army expanded into Eastern Europe. Before the breakup of the Soviet bloc, citizens in countries such as Poland, Hungary, and Czechoslovakia were denied the right to self-determination and subjected to violent repression by the Soviet state. Yet did these actions justify atrocities by the United States? And were pronouncements by Western leaders of an international communist conspiracy the result of realism or propaganda? One theory can be found in National Security Council Document 68, released internally in the year 1950. It states that U.S. military superiority was a policy which the United States would probably pursue, even if there were no Soviet Union. We begin by testing this viewpoint through examination of five American interventions during the Cold War.
Iran, 1951. Nafiz Ahmed, author of The War on Freedom.
Mohammad Mossadegh, who was democratically elected, he became the prime minister, overwhelmingly, and he won landslide elections. And the British and the Americans were very disturbed by this, precisely because they realised that it would endanger their control of the oil supplies, because the imperative of this whole democratic process was precisely the injustice of Iranian oil being pretty much controlled by the external powers that were the United States and Britain.
Our picture could only be complete if we could show you what the conditions were like before the oil company came into being. But the British have introduced hygiene into Persia, education, and sport. In your opinion, Mr. Jackson, what would be the probable effect in Persia of British withdrawal?
I think economic disaster. The Persians think that by nationalizing oil, they are going to get rich. Unfortunately, the reverse will be the case.
The Iranians were obviously very upset by this, and they wanted oil revenues to be used to develop the infrastructure of Iran and for the benefit of the Iranian people. So if you look at the classified documents that have now come out of the State Department and the British Foreign Office, this idea was very candidly discussed, that democracy was considered to be a problem. And in fact, some of the documents clearly point out that there was no actual influence from the Communist Party, and that this was very much a democratic movement, and that British and American officials were very aware that this was a truly indigenous movement. Yet what they were saying publicly was quite different. We actually had public statements from British and American officials that this was a left-leaning government, that it was infiltrated by a very close to the Tudeh Party, the Iranian Communist Party, and that this was really an attempt by the Soviet Union to kind of get control of Iran, and this was therefore a geopolitical threat. So what actually happened as a result was the MI6 and the CIA worked together to organise a coup that would overthrow Sadek.
John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
We were afraid to send troops into Iran and use the old model. Instead, we sent a CIA agent in, Kermit Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt's grandson. And Kermit Roosevelt, with a few million dollars, did an amazing thing. He managed to overthrow, through a series of riots and a coup basically, he overthrew this democratically elected president, Mossadegh, and replaced him with the Shah.
Kermit Roosevelt.
There was some discussion, and Foster Dulles went around the table, and the only person on the State Department side whom I can remember as taking any kind of a very specific position was Ambassador Henderson, who was back for this meeting. And he said that he wanted to know none of the details. He felt that this was a considerable departure from diplomatic tradition, but he felt it was required by the situation. He wanted to approve it, and he wanted to know as little about it as possible.
And this basically happened. There was a violent military operation which removed Mossadegh and reinstalled the Shah of Iran.
And it shows a stage play about Mossadegh. They have made many allegations against me, but I know that I am guilty of only one thing, and that is that I did not surrender to foreign influences. Amnesty International concluded that the Shah's CIA-trained security force, SAVAK, had the worst human rights records on the planet. It went on to claim that the torture techniques the CIA had taught SAVAK were beyond belief. Jimmy Carter, US President.
Iran, because of the great leadership of the Shah, is an island of stability in one of the more troubled areas of the world.
And this was what established really the conditions of hostility towards US and British interference in that country on a really populist basis in Iran.
In December 1989, Romanians stormed the Central Committee of Stalinist leader Nicolae Ceausescu. He was executed along with his wife. In Iran, the people would also storm the headquarters of their oppressors. The Shah himself escaped, but many of his henchmen did not. Iranians took over the headquarters of SAVAK and executed its leadership.
John Perkins.
Really, Kermit Roosevelt was the forerunner of both the economic hitmen and this new breed of jackal that now today works for private organizations. And that set the stage for what's happened ever since. And I often look back and think, you know, what if we had instead supported Mossadegh and said, yeah, he's democratically elected, let's help him. That could have changed the whole politics of the Middle East, where we never would have had the problems that we're having today.
Despite continued aggression against Iran by Israel and the United States, including violent covert operations, it has not attacked another country in over 200 years.
Howard Hunt, head of CIA operations in Guatemala in 1954.
What we wanted to do was have a terror campaign to terrify our bench particularly, terrify his troops, much as the German Stuka bombers terrified the population of Holland, Belgium, and Poland at the onset of World War II, and just rendered everybody paralyzed.
Shortly after the coup in Iran, the democratically elected government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala was similarly overthrown. When Arbenz took office, 2.2% of Guatemalans owned 70% of the arable land. Arbenz programs included giving away uncultivated land grants to around 100,000 landless peasants. He also instituted a program of support for union rights and other basic reforms. Arbenz is best described as a moderate progressive, not a Marxist, yet his programs were met with outrage in Washington. Especially concerned were shareholders of Rockefeller's United Fruit Company. Under the dictator Jorge Ubico, United Fruit had established control of 42% of Guatemala's land and was exempted from taxes and import duties.
James Petras, Professor Emeritus from Binghamton University.
The United Fruit Company really owned half the country, literally, and only a third of the land that the million-acre plantations, only a third of it was cultivated. On the other hand, you had several hundreds of thousands of landless Indian workers, rural workers, who were in dire poverty.
The case of United Fruit presents a particularly glaring example of the evolving symbiotic relationship between powerful corporations and the American state. CIA Director Alan Dulles belonged to United Fruit's law firm and held shares in the company. John Morris Cabot, Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs, was the brother of a former United Fruit president. And President Eisenhower's personal secretary was married to the head of United Fruit's public relations department. Clearly, Arbenz had to go. The problem was that he was not a communist, nor did his government have any links to the Soviet Union. In fact, Guatemala didn't even have diplomatic relations with Russia. The solution came by way of a man named Edward Bernays. Known as the father of public relations, Bernays was a major figure in the development of advertising and propaganda.
John Stauber from the Center for Media and Democracy.
Eddie Bernays is known as the father spin or the father of public relations. Fascinating individual. He was double nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he actually learned fundamental techniques of human psychology and the ability to manipulate and manage human behavior from Uncle Sigmund. And he, at the same time, publicized and promoted Uncle Sigmund in the United States, and then aggrandized himself with his association with his uncle. Eddie Bernays believed that fundamentally democracy was untenable and that people are just too stupid to govern ourselves in a democracy. And so his rationalization was that there needed to be this elite of guardians, if you will, of public policy and public opinion who would manage society, and that the public relation practitioner would be a professional who would work for government and industry in managing and manipulating and doing what Eddie called engineering consent. In the 1930s, a journalist friend of Eddie Bernays by the name of Carl van Wegen came back from Nazi Germany, and he had interviewed Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister. And he said to his friend Eddie Bernays, "Eddie, Joseph Goebbels has an even bigger propaganda library than yours, and he reads and uses all your books." And when Sheldon Rampton and I were writing about this in the 90s, we wrote a passage saying that we sort of wondered if maybe at some point Bernays, a liberal Jewish intellectual, began to realize that this technique of manipulating and managing public opinion and behavior that he thought was essential to preserve democracy might not just as easily be used in the wrong hands to subvert democracy. That question we raised was sort of answered later for us when we found out that indeed Bernays was completely comfortable helping to engineer and manage this overthrow of the elected government of Guatemala, and he was well aware of what had resulted from that.
Bernays' strategy was to take the anti-communist model used during the coup in Iran and turn it into a media blitz. Bernays was offered huge sums of money to develop a propaganda campaign against Arbenz and the people of Guatemala. Shortly before the coup, articles began appearing in the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, The New York Herald Tribune, Newsweek, Time, The New Leader, and other publications concerning the growing influence of Guatemala's communists. Guatemala was the new battleground in the war against the Soviets.
In Guatemala, the Jacob Arbenz regime became increasingly communistic after its inauguration in 1951. Communists in the Congress and high governmental positions controlled major committees, labor and farm groups, and propaganda facilities. They agitated and led in demonstrations against neighboring countries and the United States.
James Petras, Professor Emeritus from Binghamton University.
And Arbenz was overthrown in order to restore to power a right-wing regime. And from 1954 to 1990, when some sort of a peace accord was signed, 225,000 Indians mostly were murdered in Guatemala by the CIA-installed military regime. So it was a victory for the U.S. in the Cold War, but it was a terrible genocidal situation in Guatemala, finally recognized, at least verbally, by Clinton, who actually apologized to the Guatemalan people for the destruction which resulted from the U.S. military coup.
This is the first time in the history of the world that the communist government has been overthrown by the people. And for that, we congratulate you and the people of Guatemala for the support they have given. And we are sure that under your leadership, supported by the people whom I have met by the hundreds on my visit to Guatemala, that Guatemala is going to enter a new era in which there will be prosperity for the people, together with liberty for the people.
Marcia Espraza, the Historical Memory Project.
I founded the Historical Memory Project in 2001, when I organized the first conference for the project to create a forum to discuss the genocide in Guatemala, because in 2000 I came back from Guatemala after 3 years of working with the UN Truth Commission, collecting war survivors' testimonies, field work that we did for about a year in the highlands of Guatemala. And so when I came back to the States, well, first I was struck by the lack of discussion there is currently with regards to indigenous peoples in the Latin American context, and also the lack of discussion of academic or scholarly discussion about genocide and state violence during the Cold War years. In the context of a 36-year war, civil war in Guatemala, the Guatemalan state committed genocide against four indigenous groups. Indigenous peoples throughout the Americas continue to be a vulnerable population targeted for elimination by the state. I took testimonies of war survivors there, massacres, you know, smashing babies against trees and raping women and all the terrible things that we learned through the collection of testimonies. But I think that the most important thing to understand is how U.S. ideologies of national security doctrine resonated with local ideologies that polarized and fragmented society with this notion of the internal enemy. The ideology behind the national security doctrine that was implemented throughout the Americas during the Cold War years said that there was an enemy inside the population, not outside, because armies supposedly are supposed to protect borders from an external enemy. But the national security doctrine said to the military, you know, local armies over there, was to say, look, you need to find the terrorist or the internal enemy inside the country. So anyone could, you know, was perceived by the army, by militaries and death squads and paramilitary forces as the internal enemy. What that did was to turn people against each other. Indigenous communities are usually very tight. People rely on each other, families rely on each other. It's very different from the Western notion of neighborhoods or communities. In Guatemala, indigenous people depend on each other for survival. So when you insert fear and you insert in within the community, at the heart of the communities, this notion of the internal enemy, the impact was terrible, you know, again, because you fragmented families and entire communities that became suspicious to one another. Trust and solidarity within these communities have been very difficult to rebuild. And that, to me, it's very important to consider when we look at atrocities in Latin America. What has been the aftermath of these atrocities, the long-lasting consequences of violence?
Che Guevara speaks to the UN. Humanity has had enough and has set itself in motion. Its giant steps will not stop until they lead to true independence. I wanted to mention one case in particular, the painful one of the Congo, unique in modern history. This shows how one can flout with total impunity and the most insolent cynicism the rights of peoples. Under the United Nations flag, Lumumba was killed in the Congo, and it's the same United Nations which the Americans want to send to inspect their own territory. Congo, 1961.
Similar events to that of Guatemala would unfold in the Congo after Patrice Lumumba was elected prime minister, setting a tragic pattern for all of Africa. The post-World War II era gave birth to revolutionary movements across the continent, threatening old colonial powers. As with the French in Indochina, the colonial powers first attempted to crush such movements through violence. Eventually, however, nominal independence, featuring corrupt governments, became the model of choice.
Peter Linebaum, author of The Many-Headed Hydra.
Okay. Colonialism is when one polity, one political economy, dominates and conquers another. Neocolonialism is when the imperial power takes down its flag and a local national puts up its flag. But the economic relations remain the same. That is, the imperialist country still extracts value from the human beings in the colony, but now is done in the name of trade. Neocolonialism means so-called independence for states, but all that basically means is they have their own flag, sometimes their own airlines, and perhaps their own stamps, and their own coinage.
In the case of the Congo, an estimated 8 to 10 million people had died via forced labor and murder under King Leopold of Belgium. Now, the Congolese people would be granted independence, or so they believed. The first elected prime minister was Patrice Lumumba, who had been raised in a mud brick house.
Fighters for independence, victorious today, I salute you on behalf of the Congolese government. We've had our share of ironies and insults. We've suffered blows morning, noon and night simply for being Negroes. Who can forget the shootings, the deaths of so many brothers who would not be cowed by a regime based on oppression and exploitation?
D'oppression et d'exploitation.
Lumumba's speech, as well as his belief that the Congo's vast mineral wealth should belong to the people who lived there, set off alarm bells in the West. Under the auspices of the UN, the Belgians insisted on retaining a strong military presence in the country. Lumumba traveled to the United States and asked for help.
It's with great pleasure that I find myself today in the United States, home of democracy and freedom.
Lumumba's overtures were rejected. Rebuffed by one superpower, he turned to the other. The Soviets gave only token support, but Lumumba's act of defiance was enough to sign his death warrant. After South Africa, the Congo had the largest working class in sub-Saharan Africa. If the Congo achieved real independence, it would pose a direct threat to Western business interests across the continent.
The United States deplores the unilateral action of the Soviet Union in supplying aircraft and other equipment for military purposes to the Congo. The Soviet action, which seems to be motivated entirely by the Soviet Union's political designs in Africa. I must repeat that the United States takes a most serious view of this action by the Soviet Union.
In 2001, the minutes of a long-buried meeting of the National Security Council were revealed to the public. During the gathering, President Eisenhower had told CIA Chief Alan Dulles that Lumumba had to be eliminated.
At around the same time as Eisenhower delivered his judgment, articles began appearing in the New York Times, painting Lumumba as a communist and Soviet stooge. They published a fraudulent claim that Lumumba had received $200,000 from the Belgian Communist Party, and without a hint of irony, referred to the first democratically elected leader of the Congo as a dictator. The CIA assassination plot got underway when Sidney Gottlieb, who headed up the psychochemical department of the agency's mind control experiments, carried a vial of poison to the Congo via diplomatic pouch. The plot was abandoned, however, in favor of a hit sponsored by the Belgians in collaboration with Congolese military officials. After being deposed in a coup, Lumumba and two of his associates were tied up and executed. Taking Lumumba's place was Joseph Mobutu. He looted an estimated $4 billion during his time in office. More importantly for the West, he allowed the continued looting of the Congo's vast mineral reserves by Western corporations. Today, the average life expectancy in the Congo is 46 years.
The United States has been engaged in an effort to stop the advance of communism in Central America by doing what we do best, by supporting democracy. Grenada, that tiny little island, it isn't nutmeg that's at stake in the Caribbean and Central America. It is the United States' national security.
In Grenada, the New Dual Movement had attempted to challenge emerging patterns of free market reform. Unemployment had dropped from 49% to 14%. The literacy rate rose to a remarkable 98%. Free healthcare and secondary education were established. Grenadians received scholarships for study abroad.
As I was teaching at Binghamton University, one of my students was actually, graduate students, was from Grenada. And when the revolution took place against the corrupt right-wing authoritarian regime, and the New Jewel movement came to power, a student asked me what he should do. I said, go back and work in your government. This is a chance to bring about some of the changes we talk about in our seminars. He went back, and the Grenadian government proceeded to implement advanced social programs, housing programs, cultivating agriculture, and generally opening the country to citizens' participation. Now, the U.S., especially the Reagan administration, was very upset with several things. One, the fact that Grenada was declaring an independent foreign policy, accepted aid from whatever country was offering it, whether it was European Union, Cuba, or what have you. And the fact that the Cubans sent a mission to Grenada to build a major airport became a pretext for Reagan to assert that this airfield was going to be a Soviet base, when in fact the funding for the Cuban construction team came from England. Nevertheless, the social changes and the independent foreign policy provoked the ire of the hardliners in the Reagan administration. The charges that Grenada was a communist base were absolutely rejected. The fact that there was a coup attempt within the Grenadian government to oust the president, Bishop, served as the detonator for the U.S. intervention.
U.S. goes to war against the Caribbean island of Grenada. Their mission, stop a Cuban-inspired coup and rescue stranded American students.
We were just hoping that someone would come get us.
But the operation is a logistical nightmare, and troops face a determined enemy.
It's time to die.
Can U.S. forces win in this Cold War confrontation? Next.
The war in Grenada was perhaps the most lopsided conflict in recorded human history. A token force of a few hundred troops was dispersed by what the U.S. military termed Operation Urgent Fury. Unlike Guatemala, Iran, and the Congo, the resources and labor of the tiny nation were insignificant, nor did Grenada offer any real geostrategic import. Why, then, did they bother?
General Alexander Haig, U.S. Secretary of State.
What we are watching is a four-phased operation. Phase one has been completed, the seizure of Nicaragua. Next is El Salvador, to be followed by Honduras and Guatemala. It's clear and explicit.
There is a Caribbean domino
of course.
Theory that's unfolding.
Well, I wouldn't call it necessarily a domino theory. I would call it a priority target list, a hit list, if you will, for the ultimate takeover of Central America.
The domino theory of communism was used throughout the Cold War as a justification for American military interventions. If one country went socialist, others would inevitably follow. This, in turn, would lead to a worldwide reduction in democracy, human rights, and freedom.
Which that's the way they operate. And others just parrot the communist line. On the other hand, outright gifts are only one way America aids other nations. As we constantly raise our standard of living, the spin-offs raise standard of other countries.
It is probable that many leaders and foot soldiers accepted the domino theory on its face. The problem is that statistical data proves that in the post-World War II era, the United States was the world's biggest promoter of totalitarian regimes. A study by Lars Schultz found that U.S. aid has tended to flow disproportionately to the Western Hemisphere's relatively egregious violators of fundamental human rights. An additional study by Martha Huggins, conducted in the 1990s, suggested that the more foreign police aid given by the U.S., the more brutal and less democratic the police institutions and their governments become. This seeming contradiction cannot be explained by the domino theory of the Cold War. There is, however, a rational explanation. As Washington moved to overthrow Arbenz's government in Guatemala, State Department officials warned of the new government that its agrarian reform is a powerful propaganda weapon. Its broad social programs of aiding the workers and peasants in a victorious struggle against the upper classes and large foreign enterprises has a strong appeal to the populations of Central American neighbors, where similar conditions prevail.
Noam Chomsky, philosopher.
One of the leading themes of the Cold War has been the domino theory, what critics call the danger of a good example. And they are two different ways of perceiving what amounts to the same thing. Could call it the Mafia Doctrine. The Godfather does not tolerate disobedience. It's too dangerous. If some small storekeeper doesn't pay protection money, the Godfather may not care about the money, but he does care about the refusal. And then it's necessary to send his goons to collect the money, but also to make an example.
To my store next Friday, I'll give you the money.
This is Friday, Babu. How many times I gotta tell you?
Keep on calling me Babu. It's Singh, mother...
I'm trying to help you.
Keep on telling me I'm your friend.
Yeah.
You don't even know my name.
You want me to catch a beating? I'm gonna catch a beating if I go back again like last week. See this guy? You see this guy? This guy don't want you to have the money because he wants to come back there and squash your head.
That's a guiding principle of world order. The U.S. has been far and away the dominant power in the post-Second World War era over much of the world, and it wants obedience and conformity. There's a fear, which is called the domino theory, that if one domino falls, one small country falls, it'll topple over the next one, it'll topple over the next one, and pretty soon all the dominoes will fall and you'll be in trouble. So, for example, if you have successful independent development somewhere, others suffering the same problems will ask, okay, why not us? And that's often pretty explicit in the internal record.
The objective was to prevent the dominoes from falling. The loss of Vietnam would trigger the loss of Southeast Asia.
If this little nation goes down the drain and can't maintain her independence, ask yourself what's going to happen to all the other little nations.
The domino theory is always ridiculed after the dominoes don't fall. Take, say, Vietnam, which was successful from the U.S. point of view. If a virus is going to spread contagion, what you do is kill the virus and inoculate the potential targets of the infection. And that's what the U.S. did. Destroyed Vietnam, never become an independent, successful country, model to anyone, and installed vicious dictators in all the surrounding countries.
Robert McNamara speaking on May the 23rd, 1962.
The actions of the ruler, President Diem, have been declared autocratic. And perhaps his personal actions are to some degree. But when one realizes the chaos he faced, the complete anarchy that existed there, it's conceivable that autocratic methods within a democratic framework were required to restore order.
The most important, of course, was Indonesia. And in 1965, General Suharto carried out a military coup which wiped out the one mass-based political party, sort of a party of the poor, killed hundreds of thousands of landless peasants, opened the country up to Western exploitation. There was total euphoria in the United States. I mean, the New York Times, a liberal correspondent, James Reston, called it a gleam of light in Asia. The Times knew what was happening. They described it as a staggering mass slaughter, but just magnificent. And in fact, in retrospect, George Bundy, one of the top planners for Kennedy and Johnson, National Security Advisor, in retrospect, he said he thought that we probably should have called off the war in 1965, the Vietnam War, because the region was inoculated. Indonesia was sound. No more dominoes. Not much point wasting more time wiping out Vietnam. But there's nothing ridiculous about the theory. That's why it keeps being resurrected. The Mafia principle is correct. If you want to maintain order and discipline, you have to make sure that there's no disobedience, even in the smallest place, and in particular, no successful disobedience. So yes, it's a dominant theme of world order in the hands of the United States, and in fact, its predecessors in imperial conquest.
Salvador Allende,
Unidos,
the United States must respect the rights of the people to develop the economy the way that it should be and the way that they want it to be. Chile, 1973.
Nowhere was the danger of a good example more apparent than in Chile. For most Americans, the date of September 11th has only one possible connotation. Yet, For the people of Chile, the date signifies an older, deeper scar. On September 11, 1973, the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende was overthrown in a violent coup d'etat. It established a military dictatorship run by Auguste Pinochet, which would last for 17 years, resulting in the torture and murder of thousands of citizens. At the height of the repression, Chile's soccer stadium was transformed into a concentration camp. Among those targeted was a man whose music now plays on this film's soundtrack, Victor Jara.
From the 2007 John Pilger film, The War on Democracy.
He was taken to the stadium, where he was a source of strength for his fellow prisoners, singing for them until soldiers beat him to the ground and smashed his hands. In his last poem smuggled out of the stadium, he wrote, "What horror the face of fascism creates. They carry out their plans with knife-like precision. For them, blood equals medals. How hard it is to sing when I must sing of horror, in which silence and screams are the end of my song." After 2 days, they killed him.
A report of August 18, 1970 by the State Department explained, "We identify no vital U.S. national interests within Chile." Nevertheless, for Henry Kissinger and other major policy planners, Allende represented a virus that could spread contagion throughout Latin America. As an example of this virus in action, one of Allende's first acts was to guarantee school children a glass of milk every day.
Henry Kissinger, U.S. National Security Advisor, 1969-73.
He had no contact with any of the people that carried out the military coup, and therefore the coup that overthrew Allende was done without contact with the United States.
Kissinger was lying. Declassified documents reveal that the coup in Chile was directed from Washington, and that the Allende regime had been under attack even before its inception. A CIA cable of October 1970 reads, "It is firm and continuing policy that Allende be overthrown in a coup." Unlike the other governments we have discussed, Salvador Allende's regime was explicitly socialist, yet it had also been democratically elected. In short, his regime challenged the entire ideological basis of the Cold War. Rather than be taken alive, Allende committed suicide in the Moneda Palace as fascist troops were closing in.
Salvador Allende.
Trabajadores de mi patria.
Workers, I have faith in Chile and its destiny. Go forward, knowing that sooner rather than later, avenues will be open along which free men will walk to make a better society. Long live Chile, the people and the workers.
Viva Chile! Viva el pueblo! Vivan los trabajadores!
In stark contrast to what Allende had in mind as a corrective to Chile's economic woes, Pinochet would embrace a radical program of free market forms as theorized by economist Milton Friedman and the Chicago Boys. Friedman described himself as a libertarian with a small L, presenting his philosophy as a more moderate variant of the Austrian school of free market capitalism. He shared with them a vision in which virtually everything is owned. The programs entailed deregulation, wage reduction, attacks against unions, elimination of social spending, and a fire sale of natural resources to transnational corporations. The Western press described the events in Chile as an economic miracle.
Marcia Espraza from the Historical Memory Project.
Economic policies that were implemented in Chile as a result of the military regime are intertwined. I mean, one cannot analyze the violence without considering the way in which these economic policies sought to be implemented. Today, Chile stands as one of the most unequal countries in the whole region. the polarization between the have and the have-nots have increased dramatically in the last 20 years. Again, as a result of these neoliberal policies or globalized policies that were implemented during the Pinochet regime, which meant the privatization of pension plans, for example, for people who retire, the privatization of universities, schools, the educational system, health, and so on and so forth. So an economic miracle for whom? That's always the question that I raise. I mean, when they talk about economic miracle, who has benefited from this economic miracle? I think that that's the key question.
Thank you all very much. It's an honor for me to be here to pay tribute to a hero of freedom, Milton Friedman. He has used a brilliant mind to advance a moral vision. We have seen Milton Friedman's ideas at work in Chile, where a group of economists called the Chicago Boys brought inflation under control and laid the groundwork for economic success.
Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine.
The thesis of The Shock Doctrine is that we've been sold a fairy tale about how these radical policies have swept the globe. That they haven't swept the globe on the backs of freedom and democracy, but they have needed shocks, they have needed crises, they have needed states of emergencies. Milton Friedman understood the utility of crisis. Only a crisis, actual or perceived, produces real change. When that crisis occurs, the actions that are taken depend on the ideas that are lying around.
Peter Linebaugh, author of The Many-Headed Hydra.
Milton Friedman was a leading monetarist. He was a professor of economics at the University of Chicago who believed that value came from money, in contrast to those who believe that value comes from human beings, that human beings and human labor is the source of all value. Milton Friedman believed it was money and gold, and therefore by changing monetary rates and doing fiscal policy, he was able to organize an economy. He was a free marketeer. He was a laissez-faire capitalist, a laissez-faire theorist, and that's part of his monetarism. Laissez-faire means let the market decide. Devil take the hindmost. Get as much as you can and run. This negates consumption, it negates health, it negates meeting human needs while a few profit. This is the theory of Milton Friedman.
Graham McQueen, co-founder of the Center for Peace Studies.
My feeling is that there's two different kinds of market fundamentalism. I mean, when I use the term, I use it to mean a deep faith in the power of the market, in the market to solve economic problems and even other kinds of social and political problems. I regard it as very naive in that sense. It's almost like a kind of religious faith. The market will solve it, the market will solve it. It's okay. The market will solve it. But they also sometimes think it's benevolent. The market will not only solve this, but it will somehow solve it in a way that benefits humanity. I mean, to me, of course, it's completely unjustified. The market doesn't give a damn how many people die. The market may solve peak oil by killing 3 billion people. There's nothing here to be worshipping. And it's type one, market fundamentalism. Type two have some kind of affection for the market because they feel that it has, for example, helped them into their positions of wealth and power. The other way to look at it, which is what I usually say, is that they're not actually market fundamentalists at all. They're bullet fundamentalists. They believe in force. And the market will just be one among many things they will use. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because I think they're equally cynical. I think they're equally cynical about market. I don't think they really have any particular affection or romanticism for the market any more than they do for God or something. That the stupid people can believe in all these things, whether it be traditional religions or the market. And that our job is not to accept any of those naive beliefs, but to manage the society for our own benefit and possibly the benefit of others. I really don't know how how often they think of themselves as altruistic. In other words, I'm not convinced that the kinds of elites we see in the U.S. at the moment really are market fundamentalists in a very deep sense. I do think their violence and force are more their thing, and that they're quite interventionist, and that they're bullet fundamentalists.
Reaching the homeland during the late 70s and beyond, and culminating in the worldwide financial crisis, the process of globalization would demand free market reforms of virtually every country in the world. Not only did they fail to raise living standards, they resulted in greatly increased misery for the vast majority of the world's people. The escalation of deprivation indicators in Brazil and Mexico, which together account for over half of Latin America's 465 million inhabitants, reveal the miracle at work. Between 1985 and 1990, the rate of child malnutrition in Brazil increased from 12.7 to 30.7% of all children. In Mexico, the purchasing power of the minimum wage dropped 66% between 1982 and 1991. In Argentina, unemployment rose steadily in the 1980s and 90s, from 3% in 1980 to 20% in 2001, while the number of people in extreme poverty rose from 200,000 to 5 million. The economic miracle in Argentina culminated in this.
Here's a quote from Benito Mussolini. Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism, because it is the merger of corporate and state power. Nafiz Ahmed, author of The War on Freedom.
Well, Grand Area Strategy was developed really during the Second World War, and it continued to develop afterwards in the early stages of the Cold War. This is grand kind of world order planning, and most of the evidence that we have for this and the direction it took came out of the Council on Foreign Relations working group that was set up in the 1940s with the State Department called the War and Peace Studies Project. And most of this material is now declassified and available. The documents that have come out really reveal a very kind of imperial, openly imperial mindset. I mean, there was the language spoke openly about establishing a Pax Americana. It talked about the necessity of transitioning away from British imperial rule to a new form of American global domination. It openly talked about limiting the sovereignty of different countries depending on their amenability to the principles of this new global economic and political order that the United States and Britain envisaged. It spoke about the need to establish international institutions such as the World Bank and the IMF and the United Nations as mechanisms to regulate this world order, but quite openly spoke about doing this in the interests of the advanced industrial countries, such as Britain, the United States, and Western Europe. So on the one hand, even though there was this sense of benevolence, there was this idea that if we don't set up these institutions, there will be this international stability and there will be this danger of Nazism, there was also this quite candid admission it would protect the economic interests of a specific group of states and the interests of the colonies themselves, and the kind of these countries in the less developed world that were trying to breaking out at this time, kind of struggling for national independence, that their interests were really not in the equation. And there were even references to the need to use propaganda to legitimize this whole new structure to domestic publics.